Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I'd like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Oh, thank you so much, Stephanie. And I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop. And today's workshop is Managing the Side Effects of Immunotherapy. And this is part two of a two-part series on immuno-oncology, a promising new approach to treating cancer. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration and all of your interest in the program today that we have over 660 participants on the program today. And you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, the Netherlands, Mexico, Serbia, and the United Kingdom. So it's a global call. You're really from all over the world. And today's activity was supported by AstraZeneca, Bristol-Myers Squibb, and an independent educational grant from Merck & Company, Inc. And I really want to thank them for their support of this entire series, this two-part series, today's program as well, and also for their corporate partnership in making this program possible. Now, we have the best of the best speakers on the program today, so I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Susan Slovin. Dr. Slovin is attending physician, genitourinary oncology service, Sidney Kimmel Center for Prostate and Urologic Diseases, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, professor of medicine, Department of Medicine, Weill College of Cornell University. And Dr. Slovin is going to address how the side effects of immunotherapy differ from chemotherapy side effects. She also will give you a bit of an overview of immunotherapy as well, review potential side effects with guidelines for follow-up care, tips to manage fatigue, flu-like symptoms, fever, and diarrhea, and talking with your healthcare team about quality of life concerns. And Dr. Slovin is going to be comprehensive in providing you some of these side effects. It doesn't mean you're going to get all of them, but she's going to actually give you an overview. And it's my pleasure now to turn this program off to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Susan Slovin.
Thank you, Carolyn, and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. And it's really a pleasure to at least try to indoctrinate you into a very new and exciting area of immuno-oncology. I'm actually a immunologist by training, so I've been waiting for a lot of years to see a lot of new drugs come into the market and be reasonably effective for patients with a variety of different solid tumors. We are very fortunate to have several new drugs on the market that make use of the body's own immune system to fight cancer. What's novel about them is not only can they be used as single agents, but they can be used in combination together or with other biologic agents. I guess the groundwork was made a few years ago when the development of the first autologous cell vaccine or therapy was generated by the Provenge people. It's called Cipolucil-T, and its focus at that time was in prostate cancer. It made use of the body's own cells that were incubated with a protein, then reintroduced by intravenous infusion, and it was associated with a significant benefit in those patients. Well, instead of using one's own cells, there are a new class of immunologic drugs called the checkpoint inhibitors, and they go by different names. One is called ipilimumab, the other name for it is Yervoy, and another one is nivolumab or Opdivo. Now, what makes them very unusual is in our immune system, we have a predominance of cells that are involved in allowing us to fight cancer. Why cancer arises despite this kind of immune defense, we don't know, but we do know that there has to be an engagement between a specific subgroup of cells and the foreign cancer cell. What ends up happening is that the immune system decides upon its interaction that it'll either fight the cell or it won't fight the cell, depending on how it recognizes that cell. It needs to know if it belongs to the body or if it's foreign. What the checkpoint inhibitors do essentially is try to prevent our body from generating an immune response against itself. It's as if we have a break on our immune system. And by giving drugs that will lift that break, the immune system can now react to whatever the challenge is. So these drugs are there. They have been used in a variety of different solid tumors, including bladder, non-small cell lung cancer, melanoma, kidney cancer. with a tremendous amount of success. But keep in mind, even if you are impacting on the cancer, it is not without some small or great side effects depending on the drugs. Our first experience really was with one of the earlier checkpoint inhibitors, ipilimumab, and it was associated with significant diarrhea in some cases or loose stool. Some patients felt very weak and tired. Others had changes in their thyroid function test, whereas others just had general sense of fatigue. This was hard to recognize initially because we didn't know where this was coming from, but we found out that there may be a reaction of the drug with certain cells in the body that can cause this. But what was very interesting is that the association with these side effects seemed to relate or correlate with an anti-tumor effect. Now, how do we deal with these? Well, I guess the best way anybody can deal with any side effect is to let the doctor know as soon as possible. And early recognition is really what's very, very important. So for people who develop very bad diarrhea, as we call colitis, if these patients very often had contacted the doctor at the first sign of a change in bowel habits, we could have addressed it earlier. And that includes using steroids and providing fluid. And other colleagues on this call will be giving greater detail as to how to manage this. However, the good news is that early recognition does play out, and it's extremely important because we are able now, with a fair amount of confidence, to regulate these side effects very early on, from dealing with the fatigue, the diarrhea, the overall malaise that people have, and making people really do very, very well with the treatments. It is it's important that we in-service, as we call it, or apprise people of the side effect profiles. In fact, medical personnel, nurses, and physicians are given guides to how to treat this. There's an actual what we call algorithm, which tells you what the best how to recognize these symptoms and how to take care of any of these problems very early on. It is not uncommon to occasionally get a rash, and we're very lucky to have Dr. LaCouture on the call who will address that. But other people could have fatigue, chills, nausea, vomiting, fever, all of which is normal and easily regulated and certainly treated, but you really need to let your doctor know. Flu-like symptoms, same thing, could be easily regulated with Tylenol, could be with Advil or Motrin, but again, one really needs to know early on that this is happening. The idea behind all these treatments is to exert an anti-tumor effect and benefit the patient. It is not meant to cause significant side effects such that we are hurting the patient and that patient has to stop treatment. So for every person that we would consider for any of these treatments, a thorough amount of discussion should be entailed with the doctor and the patient and the treatment team. And the reason for this is that it's helpful for a patient to be called 24 hours after a treatment to see how they're doing, and again, to always try to refresh in the patient's and their caretaker's minds that these things can happen and that early intervention. We don't want, for example, as one of my patients did a very long time ago, go back to the South and call me with a complaint of 30 bowel movements, which I had to regulate from New York City. So telling your doctor very early on if any suspicious sensations or feelings that are just very atypical to you would be very, very important. What we don't want to have happen is somebody to have uncontrolled diarrhea such that they become dehydrated, or the worst scenario could occur, such as very bad inflammatory colitis, which will need immunomodulatory agents. It can also lead to perforation and even surgical intervention. So again, knowledge is power, and anything that is out of the ordinary for you should be addressed. I will say right now that these are all very, very rare side effects. It is very atypical, but we want people to be able to be functional during the treatment. Now, a lot of these drugs are being used together, or they're being used along with chemotherapy, and chemotherapy has its own side effect profile. Some patients may experience some itching and cough and swelling of the lower extremities, muscle pain. They may feel a little bit more weak than they normally do or have the weight loss. Again, all of these can be addressed very early on if one at least brings us the attention. How do we circumvent it? Well, we can use steroids. People can get additional fluid management. There are drugs that will manage specific symptoms, but at the end of the day, the sooner these concerns are brought to the physician's or the nurse's attention, the better this will be. So I'm very excited about everything that's there. I don't mean to sound as if these side effect profiles are in any way of major debilitating symptoms, but for any drug that a patient starts, whether it's chemotherapy, a biologic, immune-based therapy, it's always important for people to know that our goal is to maintain quality of life and to mitigate as much as we possibly can any treatment-associated side effects. So with that introduction, Carolyn, I'm going to turn it back to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. Slovin, and really for really highlighting some of these potential side effects, but also focusing so much upon really that they often can be managed, and of course, the goal always is that people can get on with the momentum of their lives with quality of life that's important to them, that's really important, and you'll be hearing that theme throughout this call today. So thank you so much, Dr. Slovin, as always, for an extraordinary presentation. And for really telling us something that could take really a day to present on. So thank you so much. And our next speaker is, again, another esteemed colleague, Dr. Mario Lacouture. Dr. Lacouture is Director, Oncodermatology Program, Associate Attending Physician, Department of Dermatology, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Dr. Lacouture is unique in the sense that his whole focus in a NCI-designated cancer center is to actually provide attention to the management of the dermatologic side effects of treatment or many other issues that come up in affecting your skin. So Dr. Lacouture is going to address understanding your skin's reaction to immunotherapy, managing skin changes, including rash and dry skin, care of your nails and hair, and sun safety tips. And it's a unique topic to present on this, and I know he has lots of tips to you, so I'm going to now turn this over to Dr. Lacouture.
Thank you, Carolyn, and thanks to all of you on the call today. It is really a privilege to be here and presenting on this topic, and such an important group of medications that have been used, and the remarkable effects that these medications have by Dr. Slovin and their colleagues on improving people's quality of life in so many ways. I'm here to talk about some of the side effects or collateral effects that these medications may have on the largest organ in your body, your skin, and also on your hair and nails, because your hair and your nails are derived from the same tissue as that which forms your skin. So first, it's important to remember that the skin comprises about 15% of the entire weight of your body. It is an organ that is constantly renewing itself. You grow a completely new layer of skin about every 28 days. The skin is also a barrier. It's an immunologic organ. In other words, it defends you against infections, against radiation coming from the sun, and everything you come in contact with. So why is that important? Because many of the medications that you or your family may be receiving from your oncologist, they are meant to attack those conditions that we do not want to have, but yet in some cases they may also affect these normal tissues such as the skin. Especially immunotherapies or these therapies that activate your immune system can sometimes cause in about 30% or one out of three people undesired effects in your skin, hair, and nails. So what kind of reactions could we expect? Well, first, one of the most common is a rash. This rash usually looks like measles. It usually appears within the first 2 months of therapy and affects the center of the chest and back, and then starts spreading out to the rest of the body and to the arms and legs. What is notable about this rash is that it tends to be very, very itchy, sometimes affecting people's ability to do their daily activities or even sleep. So I want to go back to that point that Dr. Slovin made so eloquently earlier today, and saying that it is very important that as soon as you or someone you know feels that a rash is coming or that the itch is starting, to inform your oncologist so that this rash or itch can be treated as early as possible, thereby preventing it from becoming severe, and so that the medication that is providing benefit does not have to be interrupted. The rash that occurs with these immunotherapy medications is usually treated with oral medications that suppress your immune system temporarily. These are usually medications known as corticosteroids. Other immunosuppressive medications are rarely needed. Usually when the rash appears, they are treated with these corticosteroids and the rash will resolve, and these rashes are not usually indicative of an allergy, so that most people can continue their medication, their immunotherapy medication, even after they have developed such a rash. In terms of their itching, it is recommended to use oral antihistamine tablets. There are many that are over-the-counter antihistamines. These are the same ones that you would use for allergies. There are many of them that you can take that will not make you drowsy, and these are ideal to use during the daytime, such as cetirizine or fexofenadine. In the evenings, one could take an over-the-counter medication such as diphenhydramine, which not only will help with the itch, but it will also help you sleep. Other topical medications or lotions and creams are also available over-the-counter or can be prescribed by your doctor. These medications usually provide immediate relief from your itching. And then another side effect that can occur from these immunotherapies is usually loss of skin color. It turns out that some of these medications may cause your immune system to attack the cells in your skin that give you your color. So what it ends up happening is that people develop these areas on your skin that lose their color. From many patients that I have seen with this type of side effect, I feel that many of them are not bothered by this. However, if this does occur, and which it does occur in less than 1 out of 10 people, it can be treated with certain topical medications that, again, block your immune system from attacking your skin color cells in your skin, or by using other methods such as exposing your skin to a special type of ultraviolet light, similar to that which comes from the sun, at a dermatologist's office. So when any of these conditions occur, it is certainly recommended to perhaps see a dermatologist. Dry skin is also a common consequence of most of the conventional chemotherapies that are used by your oncologist, and dry skin is usually mitigated by avoiding long and hot showers, avoiding soaps that have a lot of fragrances, as well as detergents that are that contain a lot of scents. So using fragrance-free detergents and soaps is key, and keeping your showers short with lukewarm water. In addition to that, it's important to use a moisturizer all over your body, especially within 15 minutes of taking a shower, and if possible, again at night. Now there is a group of moisturizers that are available that come as sprays, so these are ideal for those people that don't like to put creams all over their bodies. Also, one must consider using creams and moisturizers that contain some ingredients, such as ammonium lactate or urea, which actually retain more water into your skin, providing an even better barrier to protect you from your skin becoming dehydrated. And finally, your nails can also be affected But this occurs more commonly with conventional chemotherapy medications, especially the ones known as taxanes. With these drugs, you may experience some pain and separation of your fingernails, which can be prevented with the use of ice packs in your hands and feet as soon as these start appearing. Therefore, as Dr. Slovin mentioned before, inform your oncologist as early as possible when you start noticing nail problems, as there are things that can be done during the chemotherapy infusion to prevent this. And finally, as we are entering the summer months, one must remember that ultraviolet radiation from the sun can not only lead to skin cancers, but can also lead to very painful and itchy or blistering burns from the sun, especially when one is receiving an immunotherapy or chemotherapy. Therefore, the latest recommendations from the American Academy of Dermatology, which is our major organization, is to use a broad spectrum sunscreen containing a sun protection factor of 15 or above every 2 hours or every hour if swimming or sweating. Importantly, to cover your entire body, you should use an amount that is equivalent to 1 ounce. So that is about the size that you could fill a golf ball with or a very small cup of coffee. So in summary, preventing irritation to your skin in the form of fragrances or detergents that are very drying, moisturizing your skin, protecting it against sun exposure, especially within the hours of 10 a.m. and 4 p.m., are key to preventing the aggravation of any dermatologic condition that may arise from your treatment. By informing your oncologist early on whenever these occur, or by seeking a dermatologic consultation for very specific side effects, you will be able to maintain your skin in the best health possible and achieve the best possible outcome from your treatment, as well as maintain the best possible quality of life. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. LaCouture. That was really outstanding. And you know, our skin, you know, people see what we look like, and to some extent it's visible. And I think all that you've described to everybody really does enhance our quality of life and our sense of our own image and how we project to the world. So this is very important. And thank you so much for all the suggestions. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A as well. Thank you. And our next speaker is Brooke Knox. Brooke is an oncology dietitian, the University of Texas, MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Ms. Knox is going to address nutrition and hydration tips to cope with diarrhea. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Knox.
Thank you, Carolyn. I'm excited to be a part of this call today. So today I'm going to be addressing nutritional concerns while on immunotherapy, some of which may include diarrhea, but also the importance of hydrating well during treatment. While various side effects from immunotherapy can affect eating, it's important to aim for good nutrition during your treatment to help with energy levels, maintain muscle and tissues, and avoid malnutrition. Patients who maintain good nutrition tend to tolerate treatments better and have a faster recovery from side effects. Constant communication with the healthcare team related to the challenges you're facing can also help them be addressed much quicker. Starting with good hydration, it's one of the first things you can do to help manage many side effects from dry mouth to constipation and even nausea. Signs of dehydration can include darker colored urine, dizziness, dry mouth, and thirst. If you are not a good water drinker, what I would suggest is to begin with carving out some time throughout the day to just, you know, drink 2 cups of water. So if you're taking medications in the morning, try to get a little extra fluid in there. If you're cooking meals, try to get in 2 cups while you're preparing a meal. Working in foods higher in fluid content can also help. Things like watermelon and yogurt and jellos and soups. In the case where diarrhea occurs, increasing fluids containing electrolytes might be helpful. There's many products on the market today for oral rehydration solutions, which are a little different than sports drinks. Be sure to discuss those with your team if you're experiencing diarrhea. Should you be struggling with frequent bouts of the loose stools, certain foods can make it worse. And so being sure to avoid some of the high-fiber foods, caffeine, fatty foods, greasy foods, and aiming for more of the white breads and the potatoes and the rices, doing more small frequent meals, in addition, can be better than doing the larger meals. So, for example, for breakfast, you might have a slice of toast with a little bit of peanut butter and some banana, and a couple hours later have some yogurt. And then for lunch, doing something like an egg drop soup with some rice might be something typical of, you know, doing small frequent meals. Other things to look out for are things with sorbitol, which can also exacerbate the diarrhea and the bloating and the gas. And so looking at different, if you're a protein bar eater, some of those might have sorbitol, or the sugar-free gums commonly have those. Choosing a lactose-free milk or lactose-free products can also be helpful, and avoiding things that are a lot more coarse, like nuts and crunchy peanut butter. And so in terms of eating, those are some tips that can help you with the diarrhea aspect. Overall, maintaining good hydration for people can be different. So aiming for 7 cups for maybe an older lady who is in their 70s might be good. And then someone who's in their 50s and a much larger frame might need closer to 9 or 10 cups of fluid. But if you are having diarrhea, it's important to drink 8 to 10 ounces of fluid after each bout of diarrhea that you're having. And so that's it for hydration and diarrhea. Carolyn, thanks so much for allowing me to be a part of the panel today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Knox. That was really wonderful, very comprehensive, and I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ahuva Morris, and Ms. Morris is an oncology social worker, and she's our children's program coordinator at Cancer Care. Ms. Morris is going to address Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Morris.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of the call today. As Carolyn mentioned, I'm an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care, and I'd like to start by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you or your loved one are coping with cancer treatment and side effects. We've been talking today about managing your care and quality of life, and I'd like to talk to you about how Cancer Care can be a part of your network. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer. Our programs include individual counseling, which is available face-to-face in the New York area and over the telephone nationally. We also offer support groups, also provided face-to-face in the New York area and over the telephone nationally, as well as online nationally and internationally. We also have education programs, practical help, assistance navigating the healthcare system, and provide some limited financial assistance. All of our services are provided by licensed master's-level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. And we're also trained to help cancer patients and their loved ones tackle the problems that accompany the disease, such as the financial demands, physical changes, social adjustment, and the overall psychological impact and care. Adjusting to and finding ways of coping with the diagnosis and treatment in all of these areas is an important part of the healing process. As you may know, cancer affects the whole person and the entire family. Asking for help and reaching out by joining a support group or by contacting a social worker for counseling is a strength. You don't have to walk this path alone. Joining a support group is a way to connect with others who are going through a similar situation or experiencing similar circumstances. Group members offer encouragement and a sense of community that can provide you with additional support and guidance. And individual counseling provides a space that is just yours to voice any concerns and navigate any of the issues I mentioned earlier. These connections help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. Feeling well emotionally can help you better deal with the diagnosis and treatment. So I want to tell you about the services we currently have available that may be helpful. We offer many online groups specifically dedicated to the needs and experiences of patients, as well as groups specifically dedicated to the needs and experiences of caregivers and loved ones. So you can register on Cancer Care's website at cancercare.org. next, and our groups offer a unique opportunity to connect with other people impacted by cancer, along with the help of a cancer care social worker to facilitate the group. We also provide, again, both the patient and caregiver support groups face-to-face in the New York area and over the phone nationally. So if you're interested in any of cancer care services, please call our HOPE line at 1-800-813-HOPE or 1-800-813-4673. And you can also find all of this information and more on our website, cancercare.org. Our website is very comprehensive, and you can find much information not only on support but on all of our programs, as well as about your diagnosis, treatment, and ways of coping. We've learned a lot from today's program, and there's definitely a lot of information to digest. Our social workers can help you understand what this all means for you and your loved ones. Should you have any questions about today's workshop or about our services, please don't hesitate to contact us. Lastly, please remember that you are not alone. Cancer Care Services are here to help you. Thank you so much for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Morris. That was really excellent. And really, again, focuses on really coping with the side effects and the emotional and social aspects of coping with them, and practical, and how you can access help from cancer care with any of the concerns you may have. So please do call us. And now we have time for lots of questions. And so I'm going to ask Stephanie to explain to our audience how to queue up for questions. We're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we do not get to your question, please understand that we will then give you at the very end, I'll give you a very clear direction of how to get your questions answered. But let's see how many we can take now. I really thank our speakers for giving us lots of time for your questions. So this is a good place to actually practice asking questions that you need to ask your healthcare team but want to get some preview information about as well. So Stephanie?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. Our first question comes from Stephanie Kay. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you so much. It's just a wonderful seminar. Thank you. Thank you, Caroline. My question is, I'm a nine and a half year breast cancer survivor, and I had Taxol for 3 months 9 years ago. My question is, is it permanent to have the peeling of the nails of the hands, not of the toes as much as more of the hands? And they do peel a lot, and they're very bothersome. And I do go to a dermatologist, and I'm going to be going to a podiatrist. So I'm really wondering more of the dermatology aspect of what else you could do. My hair did grow back, but thinner. So it does change you, I guess, from being on the Taxol.
Well, thank you, Steph. That's an excellent question. Thank you for your nice remarks as well. And I'm going to ask Dr. Lacatour if you could address this in a general way. And then, Stephanie, we do suggest you go back to your treating healthcare team as well. Dr. Lacatour?
Yes, that's a very good question. The question was relating to receiving chemotherapy many years ago and having persistent changes in your nails and hair. And it turns out that we used to think in the past that side effects to certain types of chemotherapy, especially the ones that have been used for many decades, the so-called the cytotoxic chemotherapies or the conventional chemotherapies, were only temporary. But we are finding more and more how some effects, at least from my field of dermatology, that some effects in the hair and in the nails can be persistent and last for many years after you complete your chemotherapy. These side effects that can be persistent include fragile or brittle and thinning hair, as well as the nails being very thin or brittle. In these cases, it is important to seek the attention of a dermatologist that is experienced in the side effects of chemotherapy or in conditions relating to cancer survivors, as they may want to investigate your blood to see whether there are deficiencies in your thyroid or in certain other minerals, as well as certain other hormonal aspects of your body, and replenish or restore those to their normal values. In addition to that, there are other topical medications, some of which are available over the counter or through a prescription that you can apply directly onto your scalp or directly onto your nails, which either make them grow more or appear more robust and thicker as they continue to grow. The important thing to remember, as Dr. Slovin mentioned before, is to try to inform your oncologist as early as possible, and if this is something very specific to the hair and nails, to seek the attention of a dermatologist that is experienced in these so that your body, your hair, and your nails can go back to normal and you can continue to live life as happily as you were before.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have a question from one of our online participants, from John. He's asking for a little more discussion on the medications that were recommended for itching rash and oral corticosteroids. He's just asking Dr. LaCouture if you could just say them a little bit again, as a little bit slower, and just maybe the ones that need to be spelled out so he would understand what he might be able to then ask his healthcare team about, if that's possible to do.
Yes. Well, the question is, what medication specifically should one use for itching and rash? It depends on what type of anti-cancer medication you are receiving, as there is not only one rash, but there are many different types of rashes. In general, however, one would use topical or oral corticosteroids to treat a rash. Topical corticosteroids, one of the most commonly used, is known as triamcinolone. Oral corticosteroids, one of the most commonly used by oncologists, is known as dexamethasone. In addition to that, topical corticosteroids can be used in conjunction, if the rash is not severe, with tablets that are anti-itch tablets, known as antihistamines. Most common ones are cetirizine, and at night, because it can cause some drowsiness, diphenhydramine. And also, let's not forget that there are also products over-the-counter which can provide some itch relief and to some degree some rash relief. And these include hydrocortisone and topical lotions or creams containing pramoxine or menthol are also effective for itching. Thank you.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And we have another question for Dr. Slovin. So this is and this question I'm going to ask Dr. Slovin to address in a general way from Patricia. Which cells or aspects of the immune system play the major role when immunotherapy is used? Would prior treatments limit the efficacy of an immunotherapy?
So, well, that's a great
complicated question. Okay.
Yeah, it's actually a great question because the immune system is very complicated. You know, if we go back 40 years, all we knew there was a B cell and a T cell, and now we have drugs that target both. So the cell that is deemed to be of very significant importance in a lot of these malignancies is what we call the T cell, which the T stands for thymus-derived. This is the cell that's involved in immune surveillance, the induction of memory cells, cells that help or suppress the immune response, or they regulate the immune response. And there's a lot of populations and subpopulation of these T cells. B cells are the ones that produce an antibody response. That's the one that works almost immediately. Anytime you have a foreign substance, antibodies, which are serum proteins, are made that will immediately try to attack the foreign substance, and after your exposure will leave a memory cell that anytime it re-encounters that same molecule or virus, it will certainly come back and try to induce a anti-infection response. T cells do not produce these serum proteins. Instead, they run around and they actively survey what's going on. And a lot of the drugs that we have right now for immune therapy are able to change the direction, if you will, or path of how these cells work to protect our body. They actually enhance it by releasing certain factors into the bloodstream called cytokines. They engage these T cells with other soluble factors in the bloodstream. So these are the ones that are the most, in terms of the population of your immune system, but these are the ones that are part and parcel of what we have our focus on these days.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Thank you. Excellent. And we have another question in front of our telephone participants.
Our next question comes from Sandra P. Your line is open.
Hi, thank you. I just had a question. This was your second in a series. Is it possible to access the first presentation?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Actually, it's basically for those of you who have access to a computer, it is played as a podcast on our website, and you can just go to our Cancer Care website at www.cancercare.org, and it will direct you in terms of listening to previous programs. So that it definitely is available for everyone as a podcast, as will today's program. So also people, so you make a good point. Sometimes one misses a program because of one's scheduling and things like that. Sometimes one wants to hear a program again. You know, it's like a lot of complicated information to absorb. So people will actually listen to it again. After, so today's program, too, will be up on as a podcast probably, but it's usually this next day. So next day it will be up as a podcast. So just that's a great question. Thank you for asking it. I think many people don't realize that. So the nice thing about the programs is that they do live on beyond the day that we actually offer the program, which offer, you know, gives you all you know, an opportunity to kind of listen again, think of something you want to hear again. And, you know, the reality is we only take in so much of what we hear, so many people choose to listen to them again and again and often recommend healthcare teams listen to them or other family members or friends or support groups listen to them. It's a great way of getting information. So thank you for that question. And so our next question comes from one of our online participants, from Karen. Am I able to get the flu vaccines while in active treatment? And Dr. Slovin, if you could address that question.
The answer is I would be very cautious. The flu vaccine is not exactly an active virus, but the immune system is is sort of hyperactive at that point, and therefore we would recommend that any flu virus, any flu vaccine or any immune vaccine be given at least a month before or at least 2 to 3 months after the treatment is completed. We just don't want the immune system to go a little on the haywire side.
Well, thank you. And another question kind of related to it, but it's for Dr. Slovin. Will symptoms of immunotherapy treatment be magnified if my immune system is already compromised by a pre-existing condition? Would I even be eligible to try this treatment?
It's an excellent question. You know, everybody is under the assumption that they have cancer, their immune system is awry. And let me be the first to tell you that it is still in a pretty good condition. You could fight off the flu. You can fight off pneumonia. So you do have some level of immune competence. It's not every immune cell that is awry in any way, and therefore you're not going to be able to fend for yourself. In general, I would say that it depends on what your immune issue is. If you happen to have autoimmune disease such as autoimmune colitis, autoimmune hepatitis, if you have rheumatoid arthritis, for example, or hypothyroidism, hyperthyroidism, all of which are considered autoimmune diseases, then these therapies are not appropriate for you and could put you at risk of worsening conditions. So this is something whereby eligibility is always determined by your physician. It's not something you just decide you're going to do. This has to be very thoroughly evaluated prior to any sort of enrollment with these drugs. They appear to be lightweight, but they're not. And that's why you really want to make sure that you are in the best possible condition before going on these drugs.
And another question, which is related to this one again, for Dr. Slovin, I'm wondering about organ transplants. Would immunotherapy increase the chance for bodies to reject organs?
Well, if you're already having an organ that's been transplanted to you, you're already on immunosuppressive agents. These drugs would not be the best for you because they can affect your immunosuppressive agent that's sometimes known as tacrolimus, or Cellcept. There's a whole group of them. So I would stay far away from that if you've already had a transplant, irrespective of the nature of the organ.
That's excellent. And definitely we want you to share. These are great questions, and, of course, to bring them up with your treating healthcare team always. It's very important as well so that they are totally on board with, you know, with your concerns and questions. These are great questions. And actually, along the same lines, Dr. Floyd, with another question for you.
I'm running a roll today.
I have severe allergies to some fruits and nuts. Would I not be a candidate for immunotherapy? Is there any relationship between the two?
No, I think you're perfectly fine. We have our dermatologist here who will be the first one to treat you if you have a hive. Really, there should be no cross-reactivity in the drugs that we use if you have simple food allergies. As long as your allergies are well controlled, there should not be any issues. And as Dr. LaCouture said, there is different medications that can be used that can control the side effects dermatologically that from the drugs as well as anything that you already may have inherent in your condition, you know, allergies to hay fever, food allergies, and the like. Remember that when we give these drugs, again, we look at allergies. We look at things that are not typical for, you know, that I shouldn't say typical, but there are atypical that we would always worry about. So your safety is paramount. Just giving a drug because you think it's going to be the best drug is not the answer. It has to have a safety margin. If that safety margin is broached, we're not going to give it to you. We want you to live, but we don't want to kill you by treating you. That's the most important thing, and that's why we have dermatologists, allergists, and we have a multi-team approach for all our patients who have cancer.
And, you know, Ms. Knox, I'm sorry, do you want to comment on just these kinds of food allergies that people may have in terms of just, so if they're aware of them, they know to not eat those foods, or how does that, can you give us a little help with that? Because I think people often, it's hard for people often with, depending on the extent of their food allergies, to kind of stay within those boundaries.
Right. Well, generally, most people that have a true food allergy, I think you mentioned that you had one, is pretty well familiar with those types of foods. What I would caution against people is when they start to have some kind of reaction, sometimes they blame it on the food, and sometimes it's not the food. It's more medication-related. So, for example, I had a patient yesterday, and he said, oh, every time I eat peanut butter, or more recently, sometimes when I eat peanut butter, my blood pressure drops. And so, you know, we talked about it, and he had, you know, started on steroids, and some other things were also going on. And a lot of times, you know, it's better to be evaluated by a doctor that will tell you this is a true food allergy versus kind of self-diagnosing those things. And if you know, the other thing that comes up often is that when people aren't eating well, they will take different supplements, such as Boost and such as Ensure. And it's important to read the ingredients. So if you have a soy allergy, for example, you need to look at the protein sources on there to make sure that, you know, these products don't contain things that are going to set you off.
And actually, on these lines, because we really do have a multidisciplinary team here, so I'm going to ask Ms. Morris if you could comment on just the discussions that happen in the support groups that we run here in terms of people really trying to figure out how to get on with their lives with some of the kind of experiences that they may be having based on their treatment and how people have those discussions in a group and how that can be a model for people or help them to think through how to get on with their lives.
Sure, and as we've heard today from, you know, the other experts on the team here is that there are many ways, you know, your medical team can help you manage the side effects. But that being said, it certainly can have an emotional toll dealing with these side effects, especially, you know, sometimes post-treatment, once you've expected treatment to completely be over and still dealing with them can be really difficult. And it's common. So to know that it can be normal and there are ways to deal with it, but these are issues that come up often actually in our support groups. And people often find it very helpful to connect with others who know what it's like to be dealing with these side effects for the emotional support and to share ideas as well. All of our groups have social workers facilitating them to contribute ideas and suggestions for dealing with the emotional impact this can make. So I do really encourage you to go to cancercare.org to see if there's a disease-specific group you're interested in joining or our post-treatment survivorship support group. And again, we do have a HOPE line, which is 1-800-813-4673. We're all social workers who answer the line, and we're available to provide support and resources regarding managing your side effects as well.
Excellent. Thank you. And we have another question from one of our online participants from Max. Prior to treatment, I was extremely active. Now I feel too weak, and probably for Dr. Slovin. Prior to treatment, I was extremely active. Now I feel too weak and fatigued to exercise. Are there medications to treat fatigue? Do you have any recommendations to help me cope with this? Dr. Slovin, if you could comment on this in a general way.
To be able to comment, it would mandate that I would need to know a little bit more about your treatment, but whether it's chemotherapy or anything else, there's no question it does take a toll on your body, and I hear this from my patients quite a bit. Causes of fatigue can be the underlying disease, it can be the treatment, it can be depression. There's a lot of reasons, poor nutrition, dehydration. All of these can cause fatigue. As mentioned before, the fastest thing to do is tell somebody. And your physician is the best person or the nurse to analyze what it is that's making you tired. I have patients who come in who have gained 10, 15 pounds on their treatment. They haven't really done very much for the winter. They've been rather lethargic, and all of a sudden they're coping with an extra 10 pounds. They just feel like they don't have the energy to do what they do. And sometimes people, because of side effects, are off their routine. They don't get up the same time they used to. They're not disciplined anymore. And it's really very multifactorial. First thing to do, talk to the doctor. Second thing to do is make sure you're drinking enough fluid. Number three, there are medications that sometimes could enhance your energy level, but that has to be done under the aegis of a physician and further analysis of what your underlying problem is. But sometimes, you know, having had prior treatments, just being off the treatment for a bit and letting it get out of your system is very, very helpful. I wish I could be more specific, but again, one needs to know a lot more about the patient in order to try to deal with the issue. Narcotic, by the way, narcotics can actually make people very tired, so you can appreciate how complex the answer is to the question. I hope I'm helpful in just giving you some ideas that you could address with your doctor.
And definitely bring this, you know, Max, to your total healthcare team. And, you know, because fatigue is, Dr. Slovin, fatigue is one of the most commonly reported symptoms across the board in the treatment of cancer. Is that
absolutely, but the etiology is very different. And unless you talk to the patient, you really have no idea exactly what it is that might be contributing. It could be one factor. It could be multiple factors. But when you have the opportunity to talk to a patient, you have a much better idea of how to assist.
And could you explain the concept of differential diagnosis? Because sometimes it could be cancer-related. It could be related to some other health problem.
Correct. Well, differential diagnosis is what healthcare physicians, nurses, the whole healthcare team is learns to try to formulate how to help a patient. It just literally, based on the symptoms, we tend to go through in our head or with discussion with the patient every possible cause of fatigue. And then we have to take a step back and say, okay, what has the patient been treated with? What are the actual issues? And then we go through a little checkbox in our head and say, okay, this doesn't fit, this doesn't fit, this doesn't fit. The better the story, the better the historian you are, meaning the more detailed about your side effects, the more we can help you. It is a major deterrent for me in clinic when I play 20 questions. Drives me batty. So what ends up happening sometimes is people, I had a patient who said to me, I'm walking like a drunken sailor. Okay, what's the problem? That means you're weaving. He says, no, I can't walk up the steps of the subway. I said, okay, why? Oh, I'm feeling as though I can't move my legs. I said, okay, tell me more. And then after a while, it became very evident that he was not walking in any sort of peculiar gait. He did not have any physical disability. He just told me after 15 minutes that his major problem was that his legs were tired. Why were they tired? First of all, his hemoglobin was lower than normal, which is another possibility. He wasn't eating, he wasn't sleeping, and he was in a lot of pain. And once we adjusted the pain, it was like a miracle happened. All of a sudden, he went back to work, he was on the subway, the energy was there. So this is really a multifactorial discussion, because just to say, well, I'm tired, is very superficial for us. Tired means a lot of things to all of us. And the more you can communicate examples of what you mean, the better we can help you. I'm sorry for the long-windedness, but that's the best I can tell you in terms of how to proceed with this.
That's an excellent example. I'm going to ask Ms. Morris if you could comment on that as well, because I think we also spend a lot of time as social workers talking with people about, you know, what's troubling them, and also helping them to frame their concerns with their healthcare team. And it comes up a lot in the groups as well, where people bring up symptoms. I'm wondering if Ms. Morris, if you could say something about just how we help people with the language that they use, because it is very hard often for people to kind of put their finger on what actually is going on with them.
Sure, and that's one of the ways that talking to a social worker can actually help with when you are wanting to formulate your questions before you go to your team, because there is so much going on and so many different things you may be experiencing physically, emotionally, that sometimes you may be just feeling foggy, or it's hard to really identify what is it that you want to ask or know or tell your team about what you're experiencing. And so we can help you actually sit down and make a list of what's going on and what you formulate questions. Give practical suggestions of ways of tracking actually what you're feeling throughout the week. So at your next appointment, you can have something more concrete to bring back to your medical team, because it is really important to be able to have open communication with them. So again, individually speaking with a social worker can be helpful, and that's where also joining a group can be helpful, discussing with others and getting ideas of how people are going back to their team and just sharing that wealth of information with one another.
Thank you. And I really want to thank all of our speakers today. This has been an extraordinary team of experts. We've covered a wide variety of topics that are very important to all of you. And I also want to thank all of you who've queued up and asked questions both on the phone and online. It really enhances our program today enormously. It gives us a chance to talk more about issues of concern to you as well. And I want to remind all of you, this is a one-hour workshop, and that in planning a program like this, we do know that you have many questions and concerns that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. And so I do want to explain to all of you how to get really answers to all those other questions that you didn't get to ask or that may come up in the next weeks, days, months ahead. And so because we're all here for the long haul for all of you. So if you have a question about your medical care, your medical questions about, you know, either some side effects or your treatment itself, I'd very much recommend that you call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. Let me repeat that. It's the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. And actually, in our follow-up evaluation to all of you, we'll include that number as well for you and that how to contact them. Now, if you want to talk with one of our oncology social workers at Cancer Care, if you have practical or financial concerns that we can help you with, if you have that you want to discuss with us, if you want individual counseling or to join a support group, or you just really want someone to talk to because you're not quite sure, you have an appointment coming up, you're not quite sure how to frame your questions, you need a little help with that, then go ahead and call our oncology social workers here at Cancer Care. And you can reach us at 1-800-813-4673. Again, 1-800-813-4673. Or you can visit our website at www.cancercare.org. Most importantly, however, as we conclude our program today, I don't want any of you to feel that you're alone. I know that that's a feeling that people often have in coping with cancer, and also for all the healthcare professionals who work with you, you kind of wonder, well, now how are we going to resolve this issue or concern? So I want you to know that you can always call us. We are simply a phone call away, or you can visit your web click, you know, kind of a mouse click away from visiting our website as well. Either way, for our international participants or those who like to use the website, you can use our website to pose your question or concerns. And people who like to use the telephone and are nationally based, you can call us on our 800 number. So please do. I know that we're entering this warmer time of the year, and we want to be sure that you all know that. So it's supposedly going to be soon. Well, in some parts of the country, it's supposed to be going to get warmer. And, you know, it's the kind of time of year when you may have concerns and questions. Don't hesitate to call us, and we're here for you. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect, and everyone have a wonderful day.